very much for accepting our invitation. Just a couple of words about Sivan. You know that he is from CEU. He is also from Canada, Calgary, Canada, and he's a scholar of the Mongols. He knows many, many Asian languages. He's a wonderful expert of Asia, and he loves Hungary as well. He already understands quite a bit. And I think that it's wonderful that he dedicated so much of his scholarly efforts to our great king, Saint Ladislaus.
Last word.
Thanks for having me. I want to thank the audience and Marianne especially, and Dorotia and Laszlo and Andras Vadas and my supervisor Joshka, because all these people directed me when I first had an inkling that there might be some connection between Laszlo and Lancelot. They always put me on the right path, and I can say that the Hungarian scholarly community, you never walk alone in it. There's always people alongside. I'm not Hungarian, so I don't have any skin in the game, but I think that Laszlo and Lancelot have a strong connection, and that's what we're gonna explore. I know a lot of you are English is a second language learners, so if I'm speaking too fast, if I'm slurring my speech, drooling, just tell me and I'll slow down. So we start with a problem, question. What are the pre-Arthurian origins of Lancelot? That is, he's a fictional character. But what inspired his first appearance in Arthurian romance in the later 12th century in the work of Chrétien de Troyes? In short, who is he? Dominique Boutet notes that his origins, he wrote this a few decades ago, were still a mystery for scholars. Lancelot goes unmentioned by Geoffrey of Monmouth, who really kicked off the Arthurian literature. Maybe he was a Welsh churchman, writing around 1136. And his work was taken up by poets like Wace from Jersey and in 1155. And then this material, this matter of Britain, seemed to just explode onto the continental scene. Maybe it was already there, but you really see Arthurian romance take off after that. But Lancelot doesn't appear in those works or earlier material. Unlike Eric, Ewain, and Percival, and I could add Lancelot, Kay, Bedivere, the Knights of the Round Table, but the ones that Chrétien de Troyes took up in his romances, these people seem to be traceable to the Welsh material, but Lancelot seems to lack any homologous Welsh historical legendary figure that inspired his inclusion in the work of romancers. The other figures show up in this matter of Britain. Lancelot doesn't. As a century ago, when scholars like Jesse Weston were trying to take a shot at figuring out who Lancelot is, there was sort of a consensus a century ago that can be summed up like this. I doubt if any scholar would now argue that Lancelot and his relationship with the Queen formed an integral part of the early tradition. If any conversant with the literature of Arthurian the cycle would reckon Lancelot among the original band of heroes who gathered round the British king. So what we're dealing with is that Lancelot is an outsider and he comes later. This was the consensus about 100 years ago from German, French, American, British scholars who combed the sources, and that was as far as they could kind of get. So here's the answer I'm proposing, that the original inspiration for Sir Lancelot, the first knight and most celebrated figure in medieval literature, I would say, was King Laszlo I of Hungary, if you can believe it. Also known as Ladislav. He reigned from 1077 to 1095. He was granted sainthood in 1192, so that he's also Saint Laszlo. And that was in the reign of another Arpad ruler, Bela III, so about a century after his reign. The effort by Bela III to promote his ancestor, as well as the unprecedented connections between France and Champagne, where this romance was really taking off, and Hungary in the late 11th century, are the driving forces behind this king appearing as an Arthurian knight in Chrétien's work. But wait, there's another problem. The name Lancelot, or let's say Lancelot, as they say in French, is not exactly Laszlo, though it sounds like it. So why is the name not a direct match? If it was Sir Laszlo who appears in the Arthurian literature, this conversation wouldn't be happening right now, probably.
Or Victor Laszlo.
But the issue is confounded by the fact that the name Laszlo is a Hungarian version of a Slavic name. You know, the glory of rule, I guess they say, Vladislav, glorious rule. And there's a Hungarian who took this name from the Slavic milieu he was in, and then he came to Hungary, brought the name, and it evolved into Laszlo. So there's a corruption of the name from the very start. And then people are writing in Latin in the Middle Ages. So, you know, it confounds the matter. Which form are we talking about of this name? Which form was in use in a given time or place? Is the way they write it in a Latin text the way they were saying it? And, you know, the Kingdom of Hungary, I can point out right now, was multicultural, multi-ethnic. Who's to say there was one Laszlo across the board at any given time? So I'm going to play a game, and I'll call Dory up to the front. And it's a foreign name game, and I think this will be illustrative, and we'll return to it at the end.
Három önként jelentkezőt szeretnék.
We need three contestants. Is it three? Yeah, three will be good. Any volunteers? You can raise your hand. It's nothing painful, I promise. Not painful. There's one. So, I think this will be very illustrative. I don't know if I want to give it away right now what we're doing, but we're going to say four names from four foreign cultures that have a transcription in the Roman alphabet that's sort of standardized. And so we're just going to say them. Don't cheat. Don't use your iPhone, and you can write them down if you want. Anyone can play, but we're going to collect the three contestants' papers. So I'm going to start with number one. So contestants, have your pen ready. Number one, Daisuke. This is a name in another from a foreign culture. Daisuke. So try to, you know, sound that out. How do you think that's spelled? How would you write it? Are you ready? Number two, Cúchulainn. Some of you know this, probably. Cúchulainn. And for number three and four, we require a linguistic expertise from Dory, so you can loudly project these names.
So the third one is Dorontje. Dorontje.
How would that be written, you might ask yourself? Comes from a foreign culture, very different one from our own. And to you, these names might not have any standardization that you're aware of.
Can we collect
them? Yeah, so please collect the test papers now.
Okay.
explore this at the very end of the talk and reveal the correct spellings. So here's the structure of my argument. I think there's a four-point stance you can take if you want to argue that Laszlo and Lancelot have a connection. One, the absence of explanations. There are no convincing etymologies or explanations presently for Lancelot. There's not. I checked. That was the first thing I did. Etymological evidence. But a diverse range of material seems to suggest that the name Lancelot, or Lancelot, I should say, as it is originally rendered, is simply a slightly corrupted form of the foreign-sounding name Laszlo. Three, circumstantial evidence. There were political, dynastic, social circumstances which make this theory plausible. And the chronology actually works. And four, the textual evidence. There's parallels between the historical material about Laszlo I and the earliest works that feature Lancelot as a protagonist. So before... We got a problem. Dory, I need a... Can we shrink the... Some of the bottom is getting cut off. Mm-hmm. Technical difficulties. So...
Is it...
Yeah, now it's working. But is there a way to... Maybe... So, if you want to find the origins of Lancelot, you really got to go to the original sources that we have. And scholarly agreement has it that Chrétien de Troyes wrote five extant romances, Eric, Cligès, Ivan, The Knight of the Cart, and Percival. And I put stars beside the ones that mention Lancelot in some way, and I put two stars beside the first story to ever feature him as a protagonist. The problem, next to nothing is known about Chrétien. We really don't know anything about him. He doesn't show up in charters. So finding out his motives, why this poet might do something, is difficult when you don't know anything about him. But I would say it's not that big of a problem because his own works tell you who his patrons were, who was making him write. So you can know more about their motives in this case. Another problem is the chronology. The dates when he wrote aren't even known. We know the order of the romance, as you can tell because he refers to previous ones and the action in previous ones. So the order can be sorted out more or less. But when he wrote them is a topic of debate. If he wrote them in the 1170s, then my theory doesn't really work, or 1160s, as some would say. And they have this post-ante dating. The last romance couldn't have been written later than 1191. And the earliest couldn't have been written earlier than 1159. But if we take Claude Loutrel's dating in his books, I think it's called The Birth of Arthurian Romance. If we take his dating, which is based on references to texts that weren't even published until the 1180s, and Chrétien de Troyes refers to them in his earliest romance. So he says, actually, all these works must have been written in a really short time span, from 1184 to 1190. Chrétien was just pounding these romances out, and then he stops abruptly. And he dates The Knight of the Cart to about 1187, 88. He's not precise, but he's kind of got these ranges. I can't go into Claude Loutrel's whole argument, but it's extremely convincing and... surprising it hasn't been taken up more. And the second work is the German Lancelet of Ulrich von Sachsenhoven, which he claims to have translated from a foreign book of a hostage from the Kingdom of Britain who came for Richard the Lionheart and was staying in the Holy Roman Empire in Germany. He didn't go to Austria. And there the book came into the hands of Germans at one of these courts, and they gave it to Ulrich, he says, and he translated it. It must be about 1193, because that's when the hostages were there. And it more or less happened right away. So he's getting some book from some foreign language that tells another story about Lancelot. Those are the two earliest works. So now that we know where we should be focusing on finding the origins of this character and what happened, we can move on to the actual theory. I don't know, the theory of William Arquet was that Lancelot derives from Lancelot, meaning the servant. And this will be a translation of the Welsh Melwas. And this was long ago refuted by Gaston Paris, who showed that Lancelot wasn't a French name, and Melwas didn't even mean servant. And despite that, this still appears on Wikipedia or blogs about Lancelot. You know, it's long ago destroyed, over 100 years ago, and it still just shows up. Gaston Paris instead proposed that Lancelot originated from a Germanic diminutive name, Lanzo. The prefix Lant seems to have originated in Frankish names like Lantwolf, Lantfried, Lantbert, etc. Such a name be found in Breton material. Perhaps it underwent a sort of warping as it came into Bretony. And it could have sounded peculiar to French ears when they were adapting Breton sources, and further altered by these French poets like Chrétien to Lancelot. Okay, but Lantwolf who? Where's the saga of Lantwolf? And I'll get more to that point in a second. Jessie L. Weston, she agrees. Yes, it's definitely not British. We can't be looking in the British material. Must be continental, and again, she goes, well, Brittany then. The closest thing you can get to the Isles in the continent. And since Chrétien's work doesn't offer us any clues, she looked to this German, Ulrich von Sachsenhoven's Lancelot for an explanation, and proposed that maybe, since it tells a bit about Lancelot's childhood, she said maybe there's a lost, undocumented, Breton sort of folklore lay poem about a prince abducted by a sea fairy. And this is the origin. Well, which story? And so I asked, but when they keep looking in the continent and they keep focusing on Brittany, I wonder, does anyone look to the matter of Hungary? You know, did anyone think to check there? But it seems not. So in the 20th century, Roger Sherman Loomis, a very revered Arthurian expert, revived the idea that Lancelot could be found in the insular Celtic material by suggesting that Lancelot was an amalgamation of Luke Lawinac, or something, Len, I won't even try and pronounce these names, Loth and Lucien. Characters in the material of Britain whose names all start with L. He then tried to link them together into Ireland, and then ultimately to the god Lu of the Long Arm from Celtic mythology. We have a problem again. But I think every slide is going to be a problem if we can't.
But I can't do or.
Should I switch to my computer, do you think?
No, I think.
Okay.
Because here.
It's like every slide is packed, so we're going to have this every time.
Is it?
Okay. So, Loomis admits Lancelot's never connected with Ireland. But then he says, anyway, the ultimate prototype of Lancelot may well be one of the most illustrious of the Celtic gods, Lu of the Long Arm. But the problem is evidence is actually things like Luke was an Arthurian, was a warrior of King Arthur. So was Lancelot. Lu the god turned red in the sun. Lancelot wore red armor at a tournament in one episode. These are not, like, when you actually look at the evidence, you can't attach anything to Chrétien. Where you should be kind of looking. So we have another amalgamation. Dominique Boutet more recently suggested Lancelot was an Indo-European type. You can find aspects of him all through Indo-European literature, from India to Norse mythology, and Lu, of course. The problem with the amalgam explanations, or the older obscure folktale, or the obscure Frankish Breton name explanation, is that they all stand at odds with the prologue of The Knight of the Cart by Chrétien de Troyes, which is the first book to, you know, feature Lancelot as a protagonist. And it seems driven by royal command. It has a purpose, an urgency, an outline that he states. It's inspired. There's something pushing the creation of this story, which seems very weird if, well, let's look at the look at the prologue and then I'll say, so when you cut the white noise out, this is really what Chrétien's prologue from this book that could be dated to 1187, 86, 88. He says, since my Lady of Champagne, that's Mary of Champagne, wishes me to begin a romance, I shall do it most willingly. Her command has more importance in this work than any thought or effort I might put into it. The subject matter and meaning, or perhaps he's saying the plot, scholars have struggled with these terms, the matière, essence, or something like this, are furnished and given by the Countess. And Chrétien strives carefully to add nothing, and his effort and careful attention. Now he begins the story. So if you look at the underlined words, you can see he's saying, I don't really want to write this. And this is what scholars have actually long thought, because he stops writing it at one point and another poet had to take it up. It seems that he was pulled out of a poem he was actually working on and forced to work on this one. And he's emphasizing again and again, well, it's not my idea, but okay, her wish is my command. That's what he's saying. And scholars have struggled with what's going on here, but what you can say is he receives an order. So let's imagine that these old explanations that he's an amalgamation of Indo-European types is true. So this conversation between Mary of Champagne and Chrétien de Troyes, her court poet, went something like this. You gotta stop what you're doing right now. You gotta work on this poem. And this is the story, this is the outline, and you gotta do it now. He goes, okay, the hero's gotta rescue a girl and all this gotta happen. Okay, who should the hero be? And Mary of Champagne says, I don't care, just make him an amalgamation of various motifs stretching from India to, you know, it doesn't work. It's gotta be some driving inspiration. And Chrétien's other characters are found in this Welsh material, for instance. They have a legend around them. There's some kind of legendary historical character behind it all. There's a saint's life or something like this. And we're supposed to believe that some utterly meaningless thing was driving this creation. Number two, I would suggest etymological evidence. You could just say the name of Lancelot is meant to convey Laszlo. And I'll explain why I think this. François Villon, very famous poet, writing about 1461, said, and Lancelot de Behaine, where is he? He's talking about recently dead monarchs and the like. And, you know, he's a very popular writer, so people have read him a lot. And and people kind of puzzled over this, because he was clearly talking about Laszlo V Posthumus, who died in 1457. That's been identified, that has agreement. But why does Villon call him Lancelot? And, well, Villon was a commoner. Could just be a mistake by an uneducated, you know, ruffian in Paris. But the problem is French diplomats. Say, not long after Janos Hunyadi's death, Lancelot came to a man's estate. This Lancelot was poisoned in Prague in Bohemia by a lady of quality whose brother I have seen. Is this really a transformation of the name, as some scholars have proposed? Other names are correct, or at least attempted, by a number of French diplomats and historians writing at this time when a Hungarian embassy came to France and there was a marriage alliance happening. And they're all saying Lancelot. One who actually writes in Latin makes a point of saying Lancelotis or Ladislaus. And the ones who write in the vernacular consistently say Lancelot. So, modern historians tend to treat this as a flattering substitution. This is not, oh, it did work. So Shandor Eckhart suggested in 1937, he was aware of this issue, but he suggested that maybe István Várdai, the leader of the Hungarian embassy to France in 1457, Francicized the name Laszlo. After all, that would make sense why all the French authors consistently are saying Lancelot, if it's the Hungarian embassy leader that decides to do this Francicization. That would make sense. Because if some of the French writers are writing Ladislaus, but others are writing Lancelot, then, you know, that's their own choice. But if the very Hungarian person who comes to Paris is saying Lancelot, then of course they're all going to write it. It's not a bad idea, but seen as Sir Lancelot would have been known in both countries, Eckhart argues, and it was a favorable, flattering comparison with the king. And, French writers, he can show, had difficulty with these Hungarian names. When they did attempt them, they butchered them horribly. Some writers seem to try and avoid mentioning the Hungarian's names. They just mention what his position is or whatever. Many historians before and since have suggested this substitution idea. Either the French did the substitution or the Hungarians did, but someone's just filling in the name Laszlo with Lancelot. But this would only make sense, I argue, if the substitution we see for Laszlo V was an isolated situation in history, which it's not. Because how do we explain the blessed Lancelot in Italy? Esther Conrad, who's in the audience today, recently published a work on this 15th century Franciscan figure with this name. He lived in Umbria and around Milan. In the Vita of Francesco de Pavia, the subject of the Vita mentioned meeting a Franciscan friar of Hungarian royal heritage who lived in Franciscan convents pursuing a life of poverty. He left Hungary because it was corrupt. You know, the Franciscans were corrupt. And he ultimately settled in a convent near Milan. His name is recorded as Lancelot in the oldest source, before 1474. The friar is Lancelot, or Lancelot d'Hongrie, or Lancelos, or Lanceslaus, or Ladislaus, in Latin sources, Conrad points out. And you'll notice this. Sometimes the end just comes and goes. Sometimes the initial vowel is nasalized, sometimes it's not when foreigners write it, or say this name in the vernacular. Mariano de Firenze, another Franciscan, wrote a Vita de Lancelot Hungaro. You can see again, you have this Lans thing, this N coming in. And he wrote it with his own hand in the Tuscan vernacular. I wonder, did the friar Lancelot enjoy the flattering comparison with Sir Lancelot? Because if that's the argument, that this is why this happens, Did a Franciscan, you know, person pursuing poverty, an obscure person, really enjoy the flattering comparison with Sir Lancelot? I don't think so. But in later erudite editions of these vernacular texts, if they're translated into Latin, for instance, in the 17th century and so on, they change the name. The name that can come out as Lancelaus in the manuscript copies in Tuscan vernaculars suddenly become Ladislaus. Does this earlier vernacular to later erudite pattern of transcription mean something? I would say yes. It means that the people who are writing in the vernacular heard the name, and they're just sounding it out, and this is how it sounds to them. Whereas the erudite, or those writing in Latin, change it to a classicized form, because they have a kind of a classical form of the name Ladislaus, or Laszlo, in the sense that earlier writers have mentioned this guy. And a Latin well-read person can go back and consult those sources and say, okay, here's how you render this name. But someone writing in a vernacular in a very humble setting is writing it like they actually hear it. And is the audience for these saint lives meaningful? Yes, because they're just people seeking to lives of contemplation. There's no royal propaganda happening here. But if that's the argument for what we see in 1457, it doesn't work here in Italy in an earlier period or the same period. So Francesco de Pavia Esther Conrad mentions, his brothers in the order were the earliest, albeit oral, sources about Lancelot, and it was Odie who put these stories on paper. Therefore, Lancelot is how the friars who personally knew the 15th century Hungarian friar were saying his name, and it's how they heard it. I would argue. We have to presume that. And what do we do if the 1457 explanation works? Then what do we do with Ladislaus of Naples earlier? Here's some versions of his name written in the diary of Antonio di Pietro dello Sciovo. Sometimes he writes the, you know, proper Latin version. Sometimes it's Lancelot. And when the king's soldiers in Italy are recorded shouting his name, they say, "Viva Re Lancelot." They basically just said, "Viva King Lancelot." Another contemporary who was in Italy, in this kingdom of Ladislaus of Naples, records him as Lancelago, for instance. So, how much time do I have? Am I...
20 more minutes.
Okay, well, we'll just go through some really quickly. Sometimes when people write these vernacular renditions of the name Laszlo, they come out as Laszlo. But in the Austrian chronicle, Gartensa refers to Ladislaus II in the 1100s as Lancelot or Lancelot. And you notice this nasalization. We see this N. This is an Austrian source this time. But the name Laszlo, when it's written as it sounds, comes out with an N after the accented A. A Hungarian list of Jó Bagyónis from 1228 lists one of them as Laszlo. Laszlo. So evidently the name had a form like Laszlo in Hungarian around the time of Lancelot's first appearance in literature. 1091 charter from France has Ladislaus. Again, the N comes in. It's French, this was kept in France. Antoine de La Salle describes the Hungarian battle cry at the Battle of Nicopolis in 1396 as Saint Lancelot. St. Lancelot is how the Catholic Church came to know him. Why? And I just would say the simplest explanation for this widespread phenomenon is that Lancelot is a French Romance vernacular, orally transmitted, you know, version of the rendering of Laszlo. And there's a tendency to nasalize the end. So, circumstantial evidence. Bela III had a legitimacy problem, as many rulers in the 1100s in Hungary did. There was countless rulers before him, or let's say many rulers before him. The political situation in Hungary was very unstable when he took power. And there's this notion of suitability of rule. The throne's up for grabs. So he was creating a dynastic saint from his ancestor Laszlo. He made into a dynastic saint. As we all know, Gábor Planitzai has written a very good book and countless articles on this subject about what these dynastic saints mean. And I think he gets to the essence of it quite well, which is that... Oh, one before.
Sorry.
What the creation of dynastic saints adds up to is a legitimization of secular power in terms of royal and dynastic sanctity. So Bela III, when he took power and the Bishop of Esztergom wouldn't crown him and he'd come out of this complete chaos in the 12th century, he seeks to make this cult around his ancestor Laszlo. This, I believe, was a driving force in why Lancelot appears in literature. Gábor Planitzai notes that the 12th century was a time of conflicts, controversies, and reform which worked change on the holy ruler's cult. It went from, in Laszlo's time, he canonized István for the same reason, to sort of shore up his own questionable takeover of power and build this cult around a Christian saint, but István's portrayed as sort of a peaceful character. But in the 1100s, holy ruler's cult metamorphosizes into this intrepid knight, the heroic, the athleta patriae. And I would suggest Laszlo became suitable for romance in this transformation. He was just waiting to be added to a romance. So Bela III's agenda came to France. So throughout his reign, he was trying to go through the official channels to get Laszlo canonized, and finally he succeeded in 1192. Meanwhile, after the death of his wife, the Queen Agnes, he sought to marry a French royal. In 1184, his ambassadors arrived at the court of Philip II Augustus, and an ongoing negotiation started for the marriage of Margaret of France, Mary of Champagne's half-sister. And Mary of Champagne is the patron of Chrétien de Troyes. And that became finalized in 1186. And I think this unprecedented friendliness, rapport, exchange appears to be the mechanism and courtly exchange for Laszlo entering Arthurian romance. Even the negotiations between the Hungarians and the French come into romance in the mid-1180s. In Athos and Prophylus, we read of a woman who's sought by an extraordinary wealthy but far-off eastern king named Bilas of a distant empire. And he's wealthy, but the princess should choose love instead and stay in her homeland. And there was criticism of royals in France for Margaret moving away to Hungary. They said, yes, he's wealthy, yeah, Bela III, because they checked his accounts, they checked his bank account. They said, okay, yeah, he's really rich, but yeah, he's a Eastern, he's foreign, it's, don't go. But it seems like, the people who advocated and thought this marriage was a good deal and a smart move won out, because she went with Bela III. Uh-oh, this is gonna be bad. So what I'm saying is, if you mix these events with Claude Loutrell's dating of Chrétien de Troyes' work, and by the way, Claude Loutrell knew about the embassy in Hungary. He knew this was the backdrop that Chrétien was composing under. He knew that this had really affected French courtly society in the mid-1180s. But he didn't think, he even mentions it, but he didn't have this theory. But if you match his dating with what was happening between Hungary and France at the time, you get this. 1184, Hungarian ambassadors go to the court of Philip Augustus to seek the hand of Margaret of France, Mary of Champagne's sister. Both of them were daughters of King Louis VII. Ongoing talks, Bela had to prove his income first. They're not gonna just give her away to anybody. 1184 to 1186, Loutrell says, Chrétien composes Eric, and we get the first mention of Lancelot de Lac, with a Z. Could be a transcription error, could be Ladislaus, I don't know. As the third leading knight of the Round Table, first mention of him ever. He just comes out of nowhere. He's mentioned at the Round Table, not mentioned again. He's just there in a seat of honor. Apparently he's the third greatest knight. They all got knocked lower down on the list, and no one knows who he is. Otherwise unmentioned. 1185 to 1187, Loutrell says, Chrétien composes Cliges. Lancelot is the third knight, and he fights a duel with the protagonist from Greece this time. 1186 to 1187, Chrétien composes the first part of Yvain. He gets pulled off of this project. He's working, like, this is a wide scholarly agreement. Yvain's half finished, and then he's suddenly pulled and forced to write The Knight of the Cart, featuring Lancelot as the protagonist. He writes it, drops that project, and moves back to Yvain and finishes it. 1186, the marriage of Margaret of France to Bela III is finalized. She leaves for Hungary with a troubadour in her company. It's recorded. Loutrell proposes 1187 to 1188. That's when Chrétien may have composed it. The Knight of the Cart. This is the story with Lancelot as the protagonist, rescuing Queen Guinevere. But he doesn't even like the project. He stops writing it. And scholars think he must not have really wanted to write it. But these aren't exact dates, and I'd say, what if this is actually 1186, 1187? What if the reason that Chrétien de Troyes was forced to stop writing Yvain, which is agreed on, is because he's being ordered for the nuptials of Bela III and Margaret to compose a poem in honor of Bela III's ancestor that he's trying to promote? When you see it that way, Chrétien's Lancelot seems to be a product of what was going on. And by 1189, Percival appears, and the the Hungarian marriage is no longer the big dominating thing in the French courts. It's now the Crusades. And Percival is very religious in tone. It's about, you know, sacrifice. And Luttrell even proposes that Chrétien probably went off to the Crusades and probably died in the Holy Land. And that's why we never, with his patron at the time. So I want to say that there's a precedent for Hungary and its kings to feature in romance. As Sándor Csernős notes, the image of Hungary in French romance evolved significantly between the 11th and 15th centuries and follows the rhythm of relationships between Hungary and the West and the level of integration of Hungary into the structure of the Christian West. And the big turning point's the late 12th century. There's a sea change in attitudes. The early affronts are forgotten. The Hungarians are no longer with the Saracens and the bad guys and the Huns. They're now a great Christian kingdom. It just happens overnight, pretty much. As another Romanian scholar said, towards the beginning of the 13th century, the romancing fantasy world enters a new stage during which it copies the political reality in order to present it literary. Political realities, right around this time, start to be reflected in the romances. And just to show you, the Vulgate cycle, also known as the Lancelot, there's a knight named Sagramore, and he's the nephew of the Emperor of Constantinople and the son of the King of Hungary. And scholars widely say this is Bela III. So more or less, immediately after he dies, Bela III is now a knight of the Round Table. So I'm saying, when you look at that, you have to say that the Arpad dynasty was a legitimate source for knights of the Round Table in the late 12th and early 13th century. Is it that outrageous to think that Lancelot is based on Laszlo I when we know that there's a knight, Sagramore, who is Bela III? Hungary, in general, is a source for romance material. It's on the fringes of Christendom to the French, just like Wales and Scotland and England sort of were. It's a source of romantic ideas about the other, you know. As the same scholar points out, there was a very bad novel written towards the end of the 15th century with Anjou Petrunich, and it tells a fantasy story that's clearly based on the real lives of Anjou kings and Emperor Sigismund of Hungary. But he says Hungary in the story is isolated in a time-space perpetuum. It's a fantasy land. It has no real neighbors. So what I'm saying is, Hungary is being used for romance in the Middle Ages, and Arpad kings are being used as Arthurian knights. That's agreed. So we come to the last point, textual evidence, parallel episodes. Kind of the defining episode of Chrétien de Troyes' first work to feature Lancelot as the protagonist, the Knight of the Cart. This is the central storyline. But this abduction and rescue seems to mirror the most famous story of all about Laszlo, namely his rescue of a captured maiden from a Cuman. So what we notice is before Chrétien de Troyes, there's an abduction tale from the Welsh sources, but it's totally different. In the life of Gildas, perhaps 1161, it's a Welsh saint's lives, there's no heroic rescue. The clergy intervene and rescue and convince the abductor, Melwas, to return the queen to King Arthur. Monmouth, in 1136, has Guinevere run off with the bad guy, Mordred, and King Arthur never sees her again. So there's this abduction, but there's never, in the matter of Britain, there's no heroic rescue. Churchmen have to help King Arthur get out of this one. It's in stone. There's an Italian... It's not certain when it's dated, but it's mid-1100s. It's got all these knights. There's Guinevere up there being abducted. It names them. There's Arthur, there's Gawain, there's Kay, etc. No Lancelot. In the first story to feature him, the abduction of Guinevere, he's not there. It means Lancelot doesn't even exist in the mid-1100s. But suddenly, the whole character of the abduction changes on its head and becomes a heroic rescue in the hands of Chrétien and Ulrich, to a lesser extent, in the late 12th century. The Knight of the Cart storyline is a simple one. Lancelot chases down, fights, and kills the queen's abductor. In Lancelot, he defeats the abductor, but then spares him, and then the abductor steals her again, and this time Lancelot is one of the knights who storms the fortress, just one of them, and saves Guinevere. But I'd say this is essentially the most celebrated Gesta story of Laszlo, and the one around which his cult became centered. It's the rescue of the girl from the Cumann abductor that survives in the Hungarian Chronicle, and in paintings too. So here's the Gesta account. I'm sure you all know it, but most blessed Duke Ladislaus saw one of the pagans who was carrying off a girl on his horse, a beautiful Hungarian girl. Even though he's wounded, he pursues after him, and he thinks it's a bishop's daughter. But after having fought for a long time and killed and unmanned the Cumann, he finds out the girl's not the bishop's daughter. And I think if you apply the criterion of embarrassment in literary criticism to this story, you'll be convinced that this is probably describing a real event. Because any story would be better than that. He thought it was just an ordinary peasant girl, but he was such a great guy, he saved her anyway. Or he thought it was the bishop's daughter, and he saved the bishop's daughter. These are all good stories, but he thought it was the bishop's daughter, and then he just saw it was some schmo, and he's like, why did I risk my life for this? I think this is a true story. I'm going to take it. I'm going to believe it. Interestingly, the first person to address Lancelot by name in the Knight of the Cart, his name's a mystery. He's called the Unknown Knight, or he's just called the Knight. He's like a masked man in this 1187 story. That's the first one to feature Lancelot as a protagonist. And right in his climactic battle with the abductor, he's losing, and it's the first person to say his name is a young maiden who runs down to Guinevere and goes, what's his name? And she goes, I think it's Laszlo Dulac. And then she yells, Laszlo, turn around and see who's watching you. And I wonder, is that a cameo appearance? Is that a nod? Chrétien, he got the outline of the story. It's aimed at an audience. Is he nodding to the Hungarian ambassadors or courtiers, perhaps? Is this going to, were they planning for this to be read at the court of Bela III, perhaps? By the way, it doesn't seem to have been, but perhaps. So, look at these side-by-side images. There's the Laszlo cycle, the legend. There's the single combat. There's Lancelot fighting the abductor Meleagant, who comes from Melwyn in Welsh. And there's a little bit of romance, too, in the Laszlo cycle. Much has been made. Clearly in the Gesta account we just saw, there's no romance at all. In fact, Laszlo was quite mad at the girl for saying, spare the Cumann. But the story evolves, and when it appears on the church walls in the Anjou times in the 1300s, all through Transylvania, as Professor Yekali points out, probably was all over Hungary, but the churches were destroyed in the Ottoman times and just managed to survive in Transylvania. But there's a little bit of romance going on here. The girl who he saved is picking his hair. That's an intimate thing. And by popular demand, this came into the story for popular audiences. And Lancelot and Guinevere having this romance, it doesn't seem to have bothered the courtly audiences or the popular audiences. Despite our preconceptions that, they were all in line with the church's views, it seems that everyone wanted the illicit romance, and they didn't really hold it against the Lancelot or Lancelot if he has a strange, but. Jambor Yekeli, who's in the audience today, on the topic of the Ladislaus cycle and wall painting, says something that I found, in light of what I'm talking about today, too good to ignore. When he looks at these Ladislaus cycle paintings found all over the walls and he sees all the signs of what this message is sending and who the audience is, he says, the cycle fit perfectly into the revived chivalric ideals of the Angevin kings. St. Ladislaus was, after all, a saint of chivalry. His historic figure was easy to transform into an ideal knight, as happened with so many beatified rulers during the 12th and 13th century. And I'm in strong agreement with that. It was easy to transform into the ideal knight, and that's exactly what happened, but the surprising thing is it happened in France and then spread all over Europe. So the second parallel episode, and we're almost finished, is attached to this Dulac-Dulek thing. Maybe I'm grasping at straws here. But there's an interesting parallel between Lancelot or Lancelet in the Ulrich von Sachsenhausen story, which gives his childhood and what we know about the youth and childhood of Lancelot I in the Deeds of the Princes of the Poles and the Hungarian Chronicle. There's some fascinating parallels, and I might be grasping at straws here, but it appears this Dulac-Dulac element of Lancelot's name appears attached to him even in the two earliest romances, the French and German ones. It might be related to the term Lek for Poland, which was a popular exonym for Poland in the relevant period. But in the hands of romancers, and we see them do this all the time, you can read articles like Ulrich von Sachsenhausen, it becomes an actual lake or sea kingdom with mermen, where the young Prince Lancelot's taken by a fairy as a refugee after the overthrow by nobles of his tyrant father, Ban. And I wonder if that's not Simon Kesa's Benin, Bela the First, has this strange epithet attached to his name. He gets overthrown and he dies while escaping his kingdom, but his son gets taken by the sea people. And they raise an army at the end of Lancelot. Lancelot comes with his sea kingdom mercenary army and retakes his kingdom and becomes a king at the end. He's actually a prince and a king in the story. He's not a knight of King Arthur. He just goes and joins them for a while. As Matthias Miekovatvia said about 1500 or earlier, he's discussing how Lek was widespread exonym for Poland, and he basically says all the people around there call them Lekitas, and Hungarians also get the term Lengel from Lek. Marco Polo calls them Lek. Seems to have been that was the name for Poland. Well, it's easy to, if you know Ladislaus or Laszlo is attached to Poland, let's go back a bit. So I see a bit of a historical parallel between what Ulrich just told us, because Laszlo did in fact become a refugee in Lek after the overthrow of his father, Bela I. He returned to Hungary with a Polish backing and ultimately became king. His connection, association with Poland was close. You can read this line in the Deeds of the Princes of the Poles. The Polish king himself drove out King Solomon from Hungary with his forces and placed Ladislaus on the throne, who was conspicuous for his piety as he was tall in stature, the warrior of saint. Ladislaus had been raised from childhood in Poland and had almost become a fool in his way of life, in his ways in life. So what I'm saying is maybe these romance writers have some kind of, the very first romances, like Chrétien, this outline, is some kind of gesta story, where she's like, now convert this to a romance and put it into the abduction of Guinevere. Because they seem to have information on Laszlo's childhood. I mean, essentially Ulrich's work tells the story of a refugee. He's a prince, his father's overthrown, he goes to Lek, gets an army, comes back, takes his kingdom and is put on the throne at the end. That's the story in a nutshell. Well, that's Laszlo's story, after all. So I ask you, has the true Sir Lancelot at last been apprehended? And if so, then a line from Malory's La Morte d'Arthur, the work in the 15th century that, immortalized Lancelot in English literature and became the stuff of cultural memory. And when he was so arrayed, they marveled all, for they knew him, he was Lancelot, the good knight. And then they said, "Oh, my lord, Sir Lancelot, is that ye?" And he said, "Truly, I am he." So now, the name game. Do you want to bring up words and write those up? So these are the actual spellings. That's a Japanese name. That's the standard transcription. It's not just English. That's exactly how they write it in any language. That's the Romanji rendition of. Then we have Cuchulainn, a Celtic mythological figure that's from Irish. And then these next two are Mongolian names. This one, the third one's actually the name that the Mongolians gave Dori here when she was staying there. And this one is just a standard Mongolian name. And see, now, this is working out better than I hoped. I'm gonna wait to... This is exactly what you should see in vernacular medieval literature. That's exactly what you should see. And that's exactly what we see. It looks like medieval transcriptions of foreign names. When they have to say it in the vernacular and they have nothing to go on, they just sound it out. That one's pretty close. Fascinating, right? So let's say doing something spontaneous. Can we shrink this and I'll put a fifth one there?
Okay.
Let's write. Can you write Laszlo?
Laszlo.
And then let's do Lasla, L-A-S-L-A. And then you can write the next one. The end.